Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Ham Nation is brought to you by ICOM and the ID51. For more information, visit icomamerica.com/hamnation. And by Ting.com. Ting is a new mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use. You don't have to have a contract. And there are unlimited devices on a single pooled plan. Great for families or business. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit hamnation.ting.com.
This is Ham Nation, episode number 81, January 16th, 2013. The History of Single Sideband. Hello, everybody. This is K9EID. I'm in Pleasant Hope, Missouri tonight in my new station lab. And boy, what a show tonight. Oh, my. Just get set. Call your friends, call your buddies. We've been working on this show for about 2 or 3 months. I'm very, very honored to have George WNLSB. We're going to talk about the history of single sideband and about the Central Electronics Company and how it affected what all we do today. So stick around. We're going to go to Las Vegas right before that, and Gordo's got a great report from there. Let's see what's happening in Mississippi first. George Thomas, did I hear you say it's cold down there? I thought it was warm in Mississippi. Hi, George. How you doing?
Hi, Bob. Yeah, it was in the 70s about a week ago, and then this week it's been right above freezing. And down into freezing, and we're expecting 2 to 4 inches of snow tonight, which is unusual for us, and none of us can drive on it.
Oh, man. Snow, that's not fun. Well, I just heard it from Don. Don is with us, Don Wilbanks in New Orleans. Did you say you're going to have snow, Don? How are you?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I'm at home. I'm in Picayune, Mississippi. That's about 2.5 hours south, actually, of George. We're about 60 miles north of the coast, and they're saying that we may have some snow mixed with rain tonight, and we're not going to have any type of accumulation. But, you know, people down here, they can't drive in the rain. It was the funniest thing. When I first met my wife almost 30 years ago, she worked at an auto parts store in New Orleans. And when the temperature got to 45 degrees, people would go and buy antifreeze. So they have absolutely no clue what cold is down here. But it's 40 degrees right now. It's going to be cool tonight. So I've got the fireplace going behind me, as you can see. And I'm bundled up.
I see you have fire. Yeah, so you're okay, and you got your big old heavy ICOM coat on. Yeah, you're ready to go.
a little coffee here.
Golly. Well, we won't ask you what is in that cup because it's always more than water. All right. Well, we got a lot to do, so we're gonna kick it off right away by letting Gordo and Julian take us to the CES show and show us some really cool gadgets that we missed from not being there. So, Gordon West, it's all yours.
Ham Nation, welcome to the Consumer Electronics Show 2013. Let's take a look and see what is radio related. Nothing beats coming to a ham fest and seeing the gear up close. Better yet, meeting the experts, Raj, with Alenco. And Alenco is a very popular brand.
Well, thank you very much, Goro. I really appreciate your support for Alenco throughout many years. So Alenco is here to stay and grow. And we will be continuing with the amateur as well as the business commercial radios in the future.
Alenco, here to stay. Every ham radio operator operating their gear on alternating current, AC, should keep track of how much current they're pulling. And from kilowatts, the latest that we see here at the Consumer Electronics Show, and that is a digital meter that shows you at a glance how much that big HF transceiver or the small wall wart is pulling. Radio operators are always needing to make sure that their battery pack is charged up fresh. And with individual cells, LaCrosse has just the answer. Hi, Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing great today.
Now, what do we have for a great smart battery charger?
Well, what we have here is a battery charger that's more than just a battery charger. We call this the Cadillac of battery chargers because this battery charger gives you the ability to do more than one thing to the battery. Most of the time when we think of batteries, we think about just charging them. Sometimes we want to discharge a battery. We can discharge the battery with this. We can also test the battery. These batteries in this charger that right now are 2,600 milliamps, but are they really 2,600 milliamps? When you have four batteries in a pack,
sure.
If you have one bad one, that really affects the performance of the overall device. So we can do a charge and test. It'll charge the battery, test it, and tell us what the capacity of each battery individually is. I can also just do a discharge and refresh. So the memory that batteries get, we can discharge the battery and test it, and it's going to keep going through that cycle until it doesn't see a positive gain in charge on the battery. So we can condition those batteries to get back to as close to new as we want. So we can do a charge and test, a discharge and refresh, or a discharge. Each bay is independently operated, so we can do that. We can do each battery a different function on there, and you can see this on the display here where we're doing that.
Staying connected as to what's happening at home or aboard the boat, LaCrosse again has you covered. What have we got, Mark?
We've got a remote monitoring, temperature monitoring system for your home or wherever that you want to do remote temperature monitoring. This device here, we utilize three pieces really. The first piece is what we call a gateway. This plugs into the back of your router just using a regular Ethernet cable. As you can see, you just plug in here, and that communicates with our temperature sensor. The temperature sensor, you put this wherever you want to monitor your temperature.
And how many can we have?
We can have up to five different sensors
on
this particular piece. So once we have this set up, we can then go back out to a web page, which we're showing here on our iPad, but you can also use your iPhone, your Android device, or your computer, so you don't need these. And we can remotely monitor what's going on. So I can see here in my house, which I've got set up, in the garage, it's 43.8 degrees currently in the garage.
Burr.
Yeah, well, that's why we like Vegas. But we can also set ranges. If the temperature goes too low or high, or humidity goes too high or low, I'm going to get a text message or an email alert letting me know when that happened and what the range was at that point. It's really giving us the ability to remotely watch what's going on when we're not where we need to be.
If you plan to do your own installation, and we recommend that, let me tell you, going to the automobile stereo store is the place you're going to find all of the 12-volt gear that you're going to need to wire up your transceiver. Probably won't need big fuses on just a handheld connection, but if you're wiring up a 50-watt dual-band mobile, certainly consider what the automobile store has for great fuses. And Auto Store, Auto Stereo Store, even better. Check them out. Everything for 12 volts. Justin, we always tell our radio users that solar is the key. What about it? Solar is our future?
Solar is the future, especially flexible solar and durable solar. Unlike traditional glass-backed solar panels, the solar panels manufactured by Ascend Solar is flexible, durable, and lightweight.
Wow, that is terrific. Now, about how much current are we going to be able to get out of this, about a foot and a half long solar panel?
So what you're looking at here is a 4.5-watt, 1-amp, 5-volt system. Now, unlike traditional units, this has actually 6.5 watts of unregulated power. It's regulated down to 4.5 through a 5-volt junction box here.
Okay.
What that means is that during low light situations or diffuse light situations, it'll perform just as well as it would in perfect sun.
Right. So this is designed then for personal electronics like cell phones and tablets and so on.
Absolutely. This will charge any sort of electronic device from an iPod Nano all the way up to an iPad, a Kindle, or a Nexus as fast as if it was plugged into a wall.
Wow, that's pretty good. Now, it looks like we've also got some backs to some of the phones.
Correct. So what you're looking at here is a is the Surfer for the Galaxy S3. It's a protective case with a 2100 milliamp battery that also comes with the added benefit of having a SIG solar panel on the back. Now, what this is it's a great way if in an emergency situation, you can leave it out for about an hour and get that vital 5 to 7 minutes of talk time to send a few texts or make an emergency call.
Wow. Now, you also have a battery booster, battery adapter that plugs in?
We do. So this is the Jumper 4400. It's a 4400 milliamp battery.
Wow.
So in layman's terms, that means that this has enough power to charge up your iPhone 3 times. The best way to use it is you plug it into the kicker, our flexible solar panel, you charge it during the day, and then if you're camping or hiking, you bring it into the tent and power your lamp or your iPod or your cell phone at night.
So, solar is in our future. So, Dane, it looks like we have no batteries here per se, but you do have a battery, huh?
I do. This is a different type of energy storage technology. We could refer to it as a hydrogen battery. We use hydrogen fuel cells in the products.
Wow, and now, how do you charge that up?
This is called a hydro stick. It's a solid-state hydrogen storage container. So it stores the hydrogen in a solid form so that you can take it on an airplane, you can ship it, and it's rechargeable, renewable, and eco-friendly, so there's no toxic materials, no lead, no mercury, no cadmium.
Wow, and when you do charge it up, how much capacity does it have?
One hydro stick holds about 10 liters of hydrogen, and when put into this device, you're going to get about 3,000 milliamp hours. So that's equal to about 2 full iPhone charges.
Wow, that is terrific. And how does one actually get the charge into the small pack?
So this is rechargeable with a device we've created. This is called the HydroFill, and this is the world's first home hydrogen station. So this allows people to put water in the machine, plug it into the AC or to a small solar panel, and extract the hydrogen from water and to fill this up. It takes about 4 hours to fully charge one hydro stick.
About 4 hours. And how long will that stay charged before it goes back into...
This is one of the great things about the technology is that it won't discharge. So you could have this for years and it's going to have the same amount of energy stored.
Wow. New technology in staying connected and turned on. Now, for those of you thinking of powering a 100-watt HF transceiver on your technician class privileges on 10 meters, a battery like this at 4 ampere hours won't make it. Battery like this one, rated at 6 ampere hours, is getting close to powering that 100-watt radio, but you really want to do a battery that's going to be at least 7 to 10 amp hours, such as this battery right here. If you're going to be operating for quite some time, you may want to go for a little heavier battery like this at a good 10 amp hours. And finally, if you want to operate all day on HF on 10 meters, go for a big one like this, and this is 42 amp hours. Great for keeping you on the air on the 10 meter band. And Rick with Velodyne saying that always be a safe driver, never distracted. I guess one way not to be distracted, what do we have?
We have a 3D laser scanner that actually scans the environment around a vehicle in 360 degrees. This scanner actually gives the vehicle the ability to see its surroundings in real time and be able to navigate and use this information to avoid collisions as well as find its way through an environment.
Wow. So if ever you want to play radio, be a safe driver, but here you go. Wow, switching power supplies. As you'll see, there's no heavy transformer, and the switcher runs relatively quiet on HF frequencies. And as you can see by this particular switcher right here from Hong Kong, it is able to put out various amounts of 12-volt DC current capabilities, so you've got plenty of current to run your 12-volt radio in your shack during the day or night. When you're powering your 12-volt equipment, it's always good to know how much voltage you have. And nothing beats a great analog meter movement. And here we see the best of the analogs. And what I like especially are those that have an expanded scale. So when you're drawing 12 volts, you can really see what's happening under current draw. Here's an 8 to 15 volt voltmeter, and nothing beats the expanded scale. Either you're good and full, or you run out of voltage and you are on empty. Every ham needs a good multimeter, because that multimeter is going to get you out of all sorts of electrical jams, because you know what's happening. For the 10-meter band, we use a base loading system. And if you ever wondered what goes inside a loading coil, here it is, as you can see, a coil of wire. This one for the 10-meter band. Technician class operators down on the 10-meter band, I always recommend a big, large coil. Here you go. You'll work plenty of DX when the band is open on 10 meters, big coil antenna. These are great little radios, but they really do require computer frequency loading. Oh, yeah, you can dial in a couple of simplex channels, but if you get serious about using the small imported radios, get them computer frequency loaded. Here is a great ham radio switcher power supply to run your 10-meter radio, and it changes 110 volts AC to 12 volts DC. Amateur television, another area that with a technician class license, you can get involved, either analog or, as we see here, digital. Split screen, too. So today we're examining George's smoke and solder job under the microscope, and not bad at all. Let's take another look at one of his circuits, and yes, he got it nailed perfectly. Let me go ahead and fix the focus here. And George, you did well on that connection ready to be made. And digital meters, if you're doing a lot of technical work and you really need to see a tenth of a volt, this is the way to go. Plenty of choices on digital volt, ohm, and amp meters. So live and direct, this has been your CES report with Julian behind the camera lens, Hannah also behind the camera lens, and old Gordo. Thanks for coming along to Consumer Electronics Show 2013, Las Vegas, Nevada.
How wonderful. Those guys are the real pros at doing this. Gordo's been doing it for a long time. And now we got Hannah and Julian, N3JF, in there behind the camera. Wonderful, guys and gals. That was just super duper. So we will continue sending you to those places. Great job. It was wonderful. Good stuff. Somewhere through that, I was reading my favorite magazine. Got it today. Look who's on the front cover. Mr. ACU. Yeah. Electric radio. How many of you guys know about electric radio? Well, if you don't, you should. It's really a great publication. You get this, don't you, George?
Absolutely.
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I'm not familiar with it. No.
What about you, Don? You get this?
No, but I'm going to have to, I need to subscribe to that. Absolutely. I've heard of it, but I've never seen one.
Oh, it's incredible. You got it. You got to see it. Just put it in Google, electric radio. And it's all about boat anchors and just a lot of great stuff, building things and fixing things and all that. But talking about great radios, Don Wilbanks has a message for us about great radios. Don, it's all yours.
Yeah, you know, I'm bundled up tonight in the ICOM jacket, and ICOM, of course, is known for great radios, and of course, we all like new toys being into ham radio, and the wait is almost over. There have been ID51 sightings, and I understand that it has now gotten FCC approval, so you will be seeing the ID51 from ICOM for sale very, very soon, and this is an exciting little radio. Now, what's cool about this, it is a handy talkie. It is a true radio. 5-watt dual band handy talkie. It is an APRS radio, or a D-Star rather. The user interface is the same that they introduced on the ID31, which dramatically simplified D-Star. It has an internal GPS, so no having to have some goofy little thing that plugs into the top of the radio, whatever. The chip is internal to the radio. It's built-in. Built-in D-Star repeater directory and a near-me repeater lookup. What does that mean? That means that you load up all the D-Star information is already in there, and you hit the GPS, and it finds the D-Star repeaters near you and loads them in, and you're ready to go. Also, there is a lithium-ion battery pack that charges in 3 hours. I remember the old days. Well, I'm going to use my radio for the ham fest. I better plug it in tonight. No, you plug it in 3 hours, it's done. You can charge that thing on the way to the ham fest if it's a long drive. There's a broadcast radio with us, too, with active band mute. That means you can listen to your ball game or your talk show or whatever it is you want to listen to on the FM broadcast band while you're monitoring two receivers. You can monitor the VHF and the UHF side while you're listening to whatever it is you want to listen to on the broadcast. And the game or whatever you're listening to on broadcast will mute when either of the other two receivers come active. What that means is if you're sitting there, listening to whatever while you're doing communications for your marathon or your bicycle race or some other type of public service, you can enjoy that and still not miss any of your tactical calls. It's great stuff. Also, talking about at CES how some of these small radios are really, really, really hard to program, the programming software comes with this radio. It is included in the package. So you've got dual bands at 5 watts. You've got the same easy interface that they introduced with the 31. You've got the internal GPS. You've got the built-in D-Star repeater directory, the near-me repeater lookup, the three-hour charge, the broadcast receiver with the active band mute, the free programming software. It is the whole package. This is the ID51 from ICOM. And ICOM makes great radios. I first was familiarized with ICOM back in 95. One of the first radios I ever owned was an ICOM radio. I love ICOM radios. I love them all, but ICOM is just, it's so hard to beat. And you need to get involved in the ICOM experience as well. Make sure you visit ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation. You can get more information on ICOM's new ID51, now FCC approved. You can buy this very, very soon, this great little D-Star dual band handheld with internal built-in GPS. You can also enter ICOM's weekly drawing for ICOM stuff like T-shirts and hats, and I think I got the last one of these, though. But everybody who registers will automatically be entered in a monthly grand prize drawing for a free ICOM radio. So go to ICOMAmerica.com/hamnation. You'll see all the official rules and check out all of ICOM's previous drawing winners and look at all the new toys and drool and everything else. And you'll get yourself a new ID51 very, very soon. Sign up and good luck. And we thank ICOM for being a Ham Nation supporter. Bob, back to you.
Thanks very much, Don. We appreciate you doing such a good job on those. Well, we've been working on this for months, and it became such a major deal for us working on this. We're going to split it up into two parts. And tonight I'm bringing one of my good friends and a friend of Ham Radio and all about good old boat anchors with us. And George has some incredible history. We thought we'd bring in the history of single sideband and where it started and how it led up to where we are today. George, W1LSB, thank you very much for being here.
Well, good evening, Bob, and thank you for having me, actually. It's quite a pleasure to join you and the Ham Nation viewers tonight and the rest of the crew. You know, you talk about sideband and the history. Actually, I've been fascinated by the subject for quite a long time. I first got licensed in 1958. K1GXT was my call in the time. KN1, actually. I dropped the N when I got a technician class license. But at some point, I heard sideband, and by the time I figured out how to decode it or demodulate it, better yet, on my HQ100, I was hooked. It was just something that fascinated me, not to the exclusion of AM, by the way, but it just fascinated me a little bit more. So over my ham career, I've made more of an effort to learn more about it, and much more so recently. And that was probably brought to a head last year. You mentioned the Central Electronics meet, and I know Nick is going to join us at a later date to talk about that more in depth, but it was quite a thrill to meet Wes Shum, who was really one of the the originators of sideband in the hobby. But anyway, let's get to the... Does anybody know when sideband originally got started and who invented it? I think it's been published a few times, but if you can go to the slides, it dates back to 1915. A fellow by the name of John Carson, not the comedian. This guy was far from a comedian. He actually got a BS degree at Princeton and wasn't really through at the time. He decided to go on and study a little bit more, came up here to Boston, attended MIT for a little while, went back to Princeton, where he graduated with a master's degree in electrical engineering. And he actually stayed there for a couple more years as a physics instructor. Along about the end of 1913, AT&T knocked on his door and offered him a job. Well, he took it. And thanks to us, or thank you to him, we have something to talk about. Carson was really a brilliant mathematician. He developed a model for eliminating the carrier and suppressing a sideband, and he patented it. Now, look how long it took for that patent to go through the process. It was filed in 1915 and didn't get granted until 1923. Of course, anybody that's been involved in FM systems has heard of Carson's name for Carson's rule, which basically states that the bandwidth occupied is equal to twice the deviation plus the frequency, highest frequency of modulation. In this slide, we're looking at Mr. Carson's sideband designs. On the transmitter, it's pretty obvious that he's got a microphone. Actually, this is a diagram right from the patent. You'll see a microphone on the lower left-hand side, a carrier oscillator up on the top, and a balanced modulator. Yes, a balanced modulator, followed by an amplifier. But, hey, where's the sideband filter? We'll get into that later. On the receiver, figure two, an antenna, a coil, an amplifier, a carrier oscillator, a reinsert oscillator, and a simple amplifier. There's some moving parts that are really missing from the diagram, but you get the general sense that this was how it worked. So, moving on, Carson's design did have a weakness, and that was when you read the fine print in the patent, you realize that, yes, he could suppress the carrier with a balanced modulator. He'd figured all that out. But the way he tuned out the unwanted sideband was to very carefully tune the antenna, believe it or not. It was done between the transmitter and the antenna, in the antenna, the ACU, talk about ACU, the antenna coupling unit. But remember the frequency these folks used back in those days. Carson was more of a fellow who cared about RF, and the RF frequencies they were using were down around a couple of hundred kilohertz. So getting a high Q tuner wasn't such a big deal. But when you moved up on frequency, you had a lot of problems. So eventually, good sideband filters came along. There were three different types, the constant K, the M-derived. And eventually, a filter by the name of Walter Cady came along with a crystal resonator. And a second gentleman by the name of Lloyd Espenscheid put it to work and came up with a lattice filter. And that really cemented filtering sideband. Next slide, please. The phasing method of sideband was developed by none other than Ralph Hartley of the Hartley Oscillator. This is a little-known fact, and it actually, if you look at the patent, it doesn't say anything about sideband, at least not in the front end of it. It just talks about a modulation system, so it's easy to miss. Hartley was quite a well-educated guy, but he came along, I'd say, 10 years after the original patent that was filed by Carson, and he filed his phasing method. Let's take a look at what he did. If you start on the left, you'll see the familiar carrier generator going through some phase shift networks and an RF generator going through some phase shift networks. Dual balance modulators, dual amplifiers. There's something really familiar about this. Next slide. Well, when you bring it forward and bring it up to, let's say, the early 1950s, it's identically the same circuit or the same philosophy that was used to develop the central electronics exciters. An RF source that's shifted, and an audio source that's shifted, through double balance modulators, and that produced single sideband. It's easy to understand how filtering sideband is done. It's not so easy to visualize how phasing sideband is done. So let's take a look at that. In the top diagram, you can see we have a carrier, just an ordinary carrier with upper and lower sidebands, AM, for all practical purposes. On the right-hand side, carrier B is identically the same as carrier A. The only difference is that the audio coming out of it or going into the carrier has been shifted by 90 degrees. So the sidebands are shifted by that same amount. Now, on the lower diagram, we have identically the same conditions, two carriers, except this time we're going to shift carrier B by 90 degrees as well. Now remember, carrier B had its audio sidebands shifted by 90 degrees, and now the carrier has been shifted by 90 degrees. And in the next slide, this is where all the magic happens. Okay, the upper and lower sidebands now take on a totally different effect when you combine them. Put them through a set of balanced modulators. Both carriers get canceled out. The lower sidebands in the left-hand diagram will add, and the upper sidebands will cancel because they're 180 degrees out of phase. If you want to produce upper sideband, you just switch one of the audios by 90 degrees and away you go. Simple as can be. Difficult to visualize until you actually go through this exercise. Okay, let's move on. The next real milestone in amateur sideband technology was Bob Moore, W6DEI. Some of you may have heard about this. It was written up in a magazine called R9 in 1933. And this is really fascinating. This guy was a member of the Caltech Radio Club, and he actually published the first article that I've ever found about sideband. It covered three different periodicals between October and January, October of 33 and January of 1934. And it was single sideband transmission for amateur radio telephones. Now, this guy, once you read through his manuscript, once you take a look at his diagrams, you realize he's not just an ordinary ham. He knew a lot more. And we'll find out why next. Look at the design. He starts off with a very low carrier, 10 kilohertz, a balanced modulator, a filter, another balanced modulator. Actually, he's calling all of these balanced modulators in his publication, but they're mixers, in essence. This is a double conversion, single sideband filter transmitter designed in 1933. Well, thinking back to the last slide, what you realize is that Mr. Moore was definitely an employee of the Bell System. And I believe I've been able to track back to the fact that he worked somewhere up in Southern California, actually, around the L.A. area, and eventually moved to New York. But the interesting thing is he dropped out of sight. This was the only publication he ever did. And nobody ever heard from him after that. So he did something that was remarkable, had a few transmitters on the air, had a few friends that he worked with, and that was it. All went quiet for quite a while after that. Remember, in 1933, the Hamerlin Comet hadn't even come out yet. Think of the stability issues that he had to deal with. It was quite a feat. Moving on. From 1933 to 1947, there really wasn't a lot of activity. There were some articles put out about single sideband phone by a fellow by the technical editor of QST, and also by a fellow by the name of J.L.A. McLaughlin, who also was fairly prolific in writing. But his system, when he said single sideband, he wasn't thinking of suppressed carrier. He was just thinking of an AM system having dual sidebands and being able to reduce one of them or take one of them away and make room for more people on AM. That's all. In fact, Millen brought out a sideband adapter, which was nothing more than that, just a selective receiving filter that would switch from upper to lower sideband, but it did not have a product detector, and it did not have a BFO. However, in 1947, the world changed. September 21st, W6YX, was on the air on sideband, run by Mike Villar, W6QYT. That was the beginning. Next. Mike was quite a guy. Stanford University, PhD, one of the founders of Stanford Research. The timing couldn't have been more perfect. Once he had started that first test, it really caught on like lightning. And he got such a reputation that Wes Shum actually hired Mike as a consultant early on to help him start Central Electronics and to get things off the ground. Next. 1948. If you go back and look in QSTs, those of you that have access to the QST archives, you'll see every single one of these articles in there. It starts off, and this was really a break for QST, for the league. Three articles in January 1948, including the results, you know, exactly what happened during the Stanford tests, and on down throughout the year, up to the very end. Just a preflufferance of sideband articles. Now, that started quite a rush of people to make stuff, to make it work. It caught on. People wanted it. People didn't want to build it. They wanted commercial things. So this started quite an avalanche. And you can see here how many people had really early sideband gear to be able to purchase. Central Electronics was certainly among the earliest in 1952. Elanco was another, and Eldeco was another yet. They all got on. Central, I think, was one of the ones that really lasted the longest of the very earliest. You can see Gonset, Hallicrafters, Johnson, Lakeshore, P&H, they all had something really interesting. Gonset didn't make a transmitter, but they did make a sideband amplifier. Next. Now, Central Electronics started, I believe, in 1951, but the first advertisement in QST didn't really hit till 1952. When we hear from Nick, we'll hear a lot more about the history of CE, but these are the products they made starting in 1952, and everything was a phasing transmitter, by the way. They never made a filter rig. The 10A, 1952, was a single 6AG7 phasing network. It was a coil-operated rig. When I say coils, you had to pull a set of coils out to change bands. That was the only way it changed. And there was a further improvement of it in 1954 that used a later chassis, and it had a few more features, but basically it was the same. In 54, they came out with a band switch version that had twice the power. The 10A meant 10 watts PEP out. The 20A had 20 watts PEP, but the difference was the 20A was a bit more sophisticated in that it had a band switching arrangement. No more chugging and plugging the coils. And again, it had twice the power, a pair of 6AG7s in the final. Now, the 458 VFO was actually a modification of one of the surplus command sets, a BC458. Take a few parts out, put a few parts in, and you have a very stable VFO at 5 megs. Remember, these are 9 megahertz phasing and phasing exciters. So you take 9 megahertz, and you beat 5 against it. On the minus side, you get 80 meters, 3.8. On the plus side, you get 20 meters, 14 megs. And to do anything else, you have to beat a different frequency against your 9 meg exciter, and that's exactly what it did. It had multipliers in there. The next and the biggest... No, can we go back to that one? Thank you. Down the bottom, there are two really dramatic developments that even stand today as remarkable. The 100V exciter, you take a look at it, that's all you had to do. There was no tuning. You'll see on the left there's an audio gain. You can see the band switch, and you can see a few other controls, but you can't see a load and dip control. There's a couple of little doors there in the bottom. They have things like mic gain, power control, power output, etc. But the function switch, the calibration set, it was full broadband on every band, 10 through 80. And some of them even had 160 in there. An amazing, truly amazing 100-watt transmitter. The other amazing thing they did was to come up with a 500-watt, actually it was a 600L, 600 watts input with a single 813, fully broadband linear. Bob made a comment the other night. It has two knobs, a band switch and a meter switch, and that's it. Put 5 or 6 or 7 watts into it, and you get an input of about 500 to 600 watts. It's an extremely well-built linear amplifier. It's got VSW, automatic VSWR protection, automatic plate current protection. It's built like something that came out of the factory just a couple years ago in terms of its capability and its features. Okay, now we can move on. Now, to go with these transmitters, West built an awful lot of different accessories. The scope, this was a monitor scope that went in line with your exciter and your amplifier and ran a comparison. So you could take a look at the envelope. You could take a trapezoid or an envelope pattern and look at it and get a really good, careful look at your modulation. The 10-meter adapter in the middle was for the CE458 VFO to give you 10 meters with a very stable crystal oscillator in there, a compression amp, a Q multiplier. The sideband slicer was really very common and very popular. There were two models, the Model A that didn't have the Q multiplier and the Model B shown there with the Q multiplier built in. And they were built for 455 kilohertz IFs. If you didn't have 455, you had adapters that would mix up or down to give you the 455, like the APs. Okay, next. Now, just for comparison, this was the only phasing receiver adapter available. It was a GE design, and it was something that West built a later design around, not exactly this model, but a slimmed-down version of it. This was designed by Don Norgard, W2KUJ, who worked for GE. But look at that price. In 1948, you would have had to pay $275 for this sidebanded selector. It was synchronous, by the way. There is a synchronous button on it. But by comparison, an HR07 was a little over $300, a 129X, just a little under $200. And the infamous, or famous, actually, SX42 was only a few dollars more. So to get on sideband and to do it commercially was going to cost you some money back in those days. Okay. Now, a few thoughts about Wes to wrap it up here. In my humble opinion, in those days, in that time, Central Electronics made the most sophisticated single sideband exciters you could buy. Sure, there are a lot of competitors out there. At the little meeting we had, I asked Wes who he was most afraid of as competitors, and he said, I wasn't afraid of any of them. And you know what? He was right. He was right about phasing. If you look at QST articles, last couple of years, you see phasing is coming back. Look in the web, you'll find a couple of different exciters, QRP phasing exciter. Some of the biggest names in amateur radio are now using phasing generation. And that just proves to me that Wes really was right. And to wrap it up, I'd just like to personally thank Wes and all the people that are still out there that worked with him to help bring the hobby to where it is now and make a difference. Thanks, Bob. Back to you.
What a great, great presentation. That's so great. And I know all the guys in Texas. I just got off the net before this with K5LYN with his 200V. And he runs a net. Everybody should write this down, 3870 on 75 meters at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, right before Ham Nation. And on Sunday, 14292, Lynn runs these vintage boat anchor nets, and he uses Central Electronics, and you hear a lot of it on there. George, one thing I wanted to do, I love doing this because we don't see and hear enough of this. You're talking about phasing. Phasing is a word, and how can you make people understand things sometime? How did he get rid of that carrier? Well, it's out of phase. What does that mean? You are about to hear it. And a lot of people have seen me do this many times, but it drives it home harder. George is talking about Wes's, and it goes way back to Hartley, how they designed phasing transmitters. How did you get rid of the other sideband? How did you get rid of the carrier? Well, I'm going to turn off the PR40, and I'm going to talk into this microphone, which is in phase. And this microphone is out of phase. But watch what happens when I take these two signals and put them together. If I want to get rid of my carrier, nothing. It's down 40 dB. If you heard that, it's down 40 dB. There are two signals out of phase. They both work, but together, they're gone. Gone. It's a great demonstration of phasing. It affects everything we do. And, George, I did a real quick little video of this stuff behind me. Let's run that if you've got it ready, Alex. This is the Central Electronics, and this is how I tuned it up. You'll hear the receiver. We select the band, 80 meters, 75 meters. Then we're going to put this in the carrier null. Now watch. We're going to take those two out of phase, and away went the carrier. There's our carrier null. You can hear in the receiver when I had it up, but very carefully, I'm nulling those two signals, just like with those two microphones. And when we get it all correct, a little eye up on top will tell us, but and you can also listen in the receiver. Now we're going to set the max level, and you're going to hear that signal through a receiver when I bring up the microphone.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2. This is K9EID. K9EID. Hello, 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 hello. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2.
I tuned it off frequency.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You knew that you're listening to a sideband signal.
On a Central Electronics 20A and receiving on a CM1 Mosley receiver.
There's the little receiver you're listening to. And I just had it in the background. And there's my scope. And everybody needs a scope. Everybody needs a scope.
600L.
But there's the baby, 600L, no tune linear. It's got a band switch and it's got a meter switch. And these guys today come along with their tens of thousands of dollars in amplifiers. Look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Look at that, George. Is that cool, George?
I love it.
I just thought it'd be kind of fun to let everybody see why George and I and Lynn and all these guys were so pumped up about this stuff. It is fabulous. Go to a ham fest, find a 20A, send it down to Nick. We're going to have Nick on in a few weeks. It'll probably be the first or second week of February. We'll keep you posted. And Nick and George will be back, and we'll talk a little bit. We're going to run very quickly. Run these through at about 5 or 6 seconds. We're really out of time, but I got to show these because George was at this tribute in Wes's home. So run those slides, and George, take over here.
Yeah, this is a really nice bit that it's actually equipment that Wes owned and still does. It's his own private personal collection. There you see. Look at all of it. From the 10B on the left, the VFO, the 20A, the scope that you just showed, the 600L, a 100V, and a 200V. And on the far left-hand side is serial number 110A, the very first exciter ever. And by the way, this is Wes's home. This is Sideband Susie. This was an award that was given to Wes some time ago at one of the sideband dinners. They used to have sideband dinners when it first got started. You notice half the lady is missing. It's called Single Sideband Susie. And this is Marge, Wes's XYL, who's also a ham. I wish I could remember her call sign, but they've been together forever. Got
what
married.
A sweet picture.
Yeah, yeah, she's a sweetheart too. And Wes is he's a great guy. There's Nick talking about Sideband Susie with Marge and Wes. And there's the three of us together, and that's W0YVA, who is from West Virginia, and a really big fan of Central Electronics equipment. Also a great gentleman. This is a cake that was baked by Wes's daughter. And you can just, it's upside down, but you can see it. There you go. She had the CE logo put on the top of the cake in rice paper. It was just spectacular.
Oh.
Wes was really moved by it. And there's the two daughters and father and mother. And there's serial number one. The original 10A, an Iraq mount job, too, by the way. You don't see too many of those.
You guys couldn't get that away from him, huh?
I think not.
George, this is wonderful. And this is only the beginning. We're going to come back. There's chapter two, maybe three, four, five, who knows? But thank you very much. You did a lot of work to put this together. I appreciate it. The chat room's going crazy because this is what ham radio is to me, to you, and many, many, many thousands of people of collecting these things and making them happen. And we're going to do more. We'll see you on 20 meters. We'll probably see you on the Vintage Net of Lens on Sunday, 14-292, or wherever. So, yeah, thanks so much, George. 7-3 to you, and we will return.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it, and really nice to join you.
Okay. Well, how cool. How cool. Well, we got to get going here. Don, you got some news of what's happening today, so let's hear what's going on in Newsline.
Let's do it. Roll the video. From Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1848, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, January 16, 2013. The ARRL reports that a commentary deadline of February 25th and a reply comment deadline of March 27th have been announced for rulemaking dealing with ET docket number 12-338. This measure deals with implementation decisions of the 2007 World Radio Communications Conference and certain other changes. Now, while most of the 130-page notice does not directly affect the amateur and amateur satellite services, two sections are of particular interest to the ham radio community. Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
Specifically, the FCC proposes to upgrade the amateur service allocation in the upper half of the 160-meter band at 1900 to 2000 kilohertz from secondary to primary, while deleting the existing allocation to the radio location service. This is possible because the new reaccommodation of radio location stations displaced by the expansion of the AM broadcasting band to 1705 kilohertz has been completed, and there are no non-federal radio location stations licensed to operate in the 1900 to 2000 kilohertz band. WRC-07 created a new secondary allocation to the amateur service at 135.7 to 137.8 kilohertz that already has been implemented in a number of other countries.
A link to the complete text of the notice can be found in the print edition of this week's Amateur Radio Newsline Report. A 12-month celebration of the founding of the Radio Society of Great Britain is now underway. Jeremy Boot, G4NJH.
RSGB President Dave Wilson, M0OBW, opened the year-long operation of this RSGB centenary station on the 1st of January as it was being hosted by the Widnes and Runcorn ARC. During the year, the call sign will be operated by many different clubs and groups as it moves around the 13 RSGB regions. There is an associated RSGB centenary award. Please check the RSGB website for further information.
That's www.rsgb.org. In other news, the Radio Society of Great Britain received a thank you letter from UK telecommunications regulator Ofcom in appreciation for the National Society's assistance in the area of communications during the London 2012 Olympic Games. In the note, Ofcom's Peter Berry says that one of the critical challenges for Britain was to find enough people with the right skills in radio engineering and interference management to support the needs of the games. He says the support of the RSGB introduced Ofcom to people who were very well motivated and with a high level of technical skill and expertise. He noted that Ofcom could not have provided such good service to its customers without the RSGB's help. Berry concludes by stating that the exchange of knowledge between Ofcom and radio amateurs will be an enduring legacy of the 2012 Olympic Games, and that he sees this as a model for further fruitful cooperation between the two organizations. Congratulations to all involved. The PhoneSat CubeSat, originally planned for a December 2012 launch, now looks like it will fly aboard a new commercial rocket from Orbital Sciences Corporation in February. Norm Seeley, KI7UP.
The PhoneSat series of microsat flights is a technological demonstration mission ultimately consisting of 3 1-unit CubeSats to be placed on orbit in succession. The first satellite is built around the Nexus smartphone, which will be running the Android operating system. The main function of the phone is to act as an onboard computer, but the mission will also utilize the phone's secure digital card for data storage. Ham radio-wise, PhoneSat 1 carries an amateur radio payload that will downlink on 437-425 megahertz.
Also planned for this launch, the commercial Dove 1 satellite, a technology demonstration nanosatellite based on the triple CubeSat form factor. Dove 1 plans to transmit its telemetry and image data to the ground on 145.825 megahertz in the amateur radio band, even though this is a commercial mission. The Dayton Hamvention is soliciting nominations for its annual awards program.
There are 4 Dayton Hamvention Award categories that consist of the Radio Amateur of the Year, the Technical Achievement Award, the Special Achievement Award, and the Radio Club of the Year. The Amateur of the Year is for the special person who has made a long-term commitment to the advancement of amateur radio. The Technical Excellence Award is presented to a radio amateur that has made an outstanding technical advancement in the field of amateur radio. The Special Achievement Award goes to a ham radio operator who's made an outstanding contribution to amateur radio, primarily by spearheading a single significant project. Last, but by no means least, the Radio Club of the Year recognizes an organization on several levels. These might be a contribution of mitigating the effects of disaster situations, support of public service events, amateur radio education, recruitment, youth programs, years of service, and media coverage. The cutoff date to submit nominations is February 15th. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Stephen Kinford, N8WB in Wadsworth, Ohio.
More information and official nominating forms are now online at www.hamvention.org. And still with Hamvention News, the Southwest Ohio DX Association has announced that it will again sponsor the DX Dinner to be held in conjunction with Hamvention 2013. The date for this gathering is Friday, May 17th at the Dayton Marriott Hotel. This will be the 28th annual DX Dinner, and planners say that it's an excellent opportunity to make new friends, renew old acquaintances, and learn about past DX expeditions and those in the planning stages. You'll find out more at swodxaevents.org. Episode 5 of the Youth and Amateur Radio podcast titled The Amateur Radio Bands is now ready for download.
In this episode, we discuss the characteristics of the amateur radio bands, and we highlight a high school in St. Charles, Missouri, who is in the process of rebuilding a radio club for their students. To listen to this episode, visit yarpans.com, that is Yankee Alpha Romeo Papa Hotel Alpha Mike Sierra.com, or look up the Youth and Amateur Radio podcast on iTunes. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, this is Joe Andrews, K0LLS, of Lee Summit, Missouri, reporting.
The Youth and Amateur Radio podcast service is produced by a dedicated group of young hams to serve the needs of young radio amateurs worldwide. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news, brought to you each and every week for 35 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation. And there you go. Thanks. This has been a master's level course in ham radio history tonight, Bob. This is a great show. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Tom, KF4UTH, in the chat room said it best. This is the spirit of amateur radio. This is what we went through to get here where we are today. I was blessed and fortunate enough to be there when all of this was happening. That 20A behind me, I put together as a kit. I wanted to build it. You could buy them as a kit. But I couldn't afford the whole built one, so I built the kit. There's a big story we'll tell you when Nick's here in a few weeks. He totally restored it for me, but that was my college education, learning about phasing and all the things we had to do. Oh, Tom, you're right. It is the spirit of amateur radio. And it continues down in Mississippi. George, let's continue on with some of the soldering techniques.
Okay, Bob. I recently got into a discussion with a bunch of guys on a subject here. I didn't know if I could pull this off or not, but we'll just mark it down as another experiment in solder. Alex, if you'll run the video. This week on Smoke and Solder, we're going to try another one of those crazy solder tricks and see how it turns out. There's been some discussion recently on the Amateur Logic Facebook group about homemade solder paste. apparently there's people doing it. So we're going to give that a shot. Now, I've used solder paste from Cash Olson here in the past. This is Kester Easy Profile 256. And I have had real good luck out of this. I bought a syringe several years ago, and it's got me through a number of projects, and it looks like I've still got a fair amount left. It's several years old. I keep it in the refrigerator, and it still works as well as it did when I first bought it. But we're going to try rolling our own today.
Wow, man!
And see how that turns out. We're going to need a couple of things to do this with. First, we're going to need some solder flux paste, which you've seen me use that plenty before. And we're going to need some ground or shaved or filed solder. I didn't want to really do any filing in here, and I was thinking I had seen something like this somewhere. And you may remember recently I bought this soldering tip cleaner. Well, I'm happy to report that I'm pleased with it. It does seem to work well. And if we open it up and look in there in the bottom, we'll see a lot of small pieces of solder, almost like dust. Some larger pieces in there, too, that won't be suitable. But I think we can sift through this and find some pretty fine pieces of solder that maybe we can use for some paste. I'll take out the larger pieces, and also there's a little trash in there, and we'll try to clean that out as well. You know, this process seems vaguely familiar. Here's the larger pieces that we separated, and as well as some trash. See a few little black specks in there. I think that was just some charred stuff off a soldering iron tip. And here's our finely ground solder that we plan to try making solder paste with. So we'll kind of gather that up in a pile here. And we should have 50% solder and 50% solder paste. So we'll try to get an equal amount of solder paste. That looks about the same. So now we just need to mix the two together as best we can and hopefully have some solder paste when we're finished. Well, this is the best I could do. It's not much to look at. I have my doubts on it. I'll stir it up a little bit more here, but that's probably the best we can do. I've got a little 0.1 microfarad chip capacitor here, and we're going to try to solder that to an old board I've got. This is not really made for surface mount work. But we've got a couple of traces there that are about the right size apart. So we'll put a little of the paste on there. And then sit the chip down and bring out the hot air gun. Now this is sped up a little bit so we can get on with it. You'll notice it start bubbling. And I see a few little balls of solder run around the outside there. Let's see if we did any good. Well, I think I'm going to keep buying my solder paste. Maybe somebody else can make this work. Well, we'll chalk that up as another failure here in the smoke and solder laboratories. Bob, that just didn't work out for me at all.
Well, yeah, but see, that's really cool. You show everybody, not everything we do works, you know, the first time. But when you come back the second time, it will work, or third time, or fourth time. Oh, boy. We just love your experiments, George. You're giving some things away also, right?
Yeah. You know, last week we had a question. Which of the following can be the result of an incorrectly adjusted speech processor? A, distorted speech. B, splatter. C, excessive background pickup. And D, all of these choices are correct. And we had a winner, and that was Gifford Massey, W0LEX. And he had the correct answer. He said that it was D, all of the above. Congratulations, Gifford. You've won the general class radio telephone, not radio telephone, the general class amateur radio study guide. It's a book and CD produced by our buddy Gordo and donated by cheapham.com. Thanks, Frank, for that. And we'll be shipping that out this week. And by the way, he is a technician, so he should be able to get some use out of that. And we'll check back and see see when he gets his upgrade there. Now, if you'd like to enter the contest, next week we're going to be giving away another copy of Constructing HF Wire Antennas, a great book from Jerry Buston that you can find at your favorite ham dealer. And I've got a question for that. We're going to pick another one out of the general study pool here. And let's see who can answer this one. Which of the following would reduce RF interference caused by common mode current on an audio cable? A, placing a ferrite bead around the cable. B, adding series capacitors to the conductor. C, adding shunt inductors to the conductor. Or D, adding an additional insulating jacket to the cable. If you think you know the answer to that and you'd like to win that book, send me an email at hamnationcontest@gmail.com with your answer, and you could win. Now, we've got one other contest that's running over at ICOM right now, and you can tune in and win. You can register after each Ham Nation episode for your chance to win weekly swag and automatically be entered in a drawing each month for grand prize radio. You can maximize your chances of winning by entering after each Ham Nation. So that'll be five times that you can enter this month, and you could possibly win the swag, or you could enter the grand prize, which this month is going to be the ICOM V80 Sport Radio that meets the same military specs and IP tests as the regular V80 radios. So make the V80 Sport part of your amateur radio communications plan for emergencies and everyday use, and enter the contest. That's at ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation.
Okay, George, as always, a great job, and we appreciate your time and talent to bring us all this great information. I talked to Frank yesterday at Cheap Ham. What a great dealer he is. You need anything, you need to call Frank before you do much. He's really a great guy, and he'll help you. Well, we're going to go listen to Leo. Leo Laporte has a new advertiser for us, and we're really appreciative of that. So, Larry, Leo, W6TWT, it's all yours.
Hello, Hams. Leo Laporte here. Why am I introducing myself? You know who I am, but I'm here to talk about a very important thing. Ting. Ting is the thing. You've heard about Ting. It's a mobile virtual network operator. Oh, that really clarifies things, Leo. Let me put it this way. Ting is designed to reinvent the cell phone business, to do it the way it ought to have been done. No BS, just integrity, honesty. You get what you pay for. You don't pay extra, no penalties, no contracts, no early termination fees. Ting is fantastic. Now, if you're in an area where Sprint has a good network, that's good news, because Ting is reselling the Sprint network, but they're doing it in such a great way. I want you to visit hamnation.ting.com. Hamnation.ting.com. Play with the savings calculator. Put your old phone, your current phone bill, cell phone bill in there, and then figure out how much Ting would cost. It's guaranteed you're going to be a lot less. Let's start with how many handsets do you want? Family of four, four handsets, a business, 20, unlimited, $6 per handset per month, flat fee. And then you add the features you want. But here's the beauty part. You know, you buy minutes, you buy text messages, you buy data. But if you use less, they refund you the cost every month. Not a credit. They give you a refund. If you buy more, they don't give you a penalty. They don't ding you. You just pay what the next tier up would be. And it's very affordable. Look at the page. You'll see great prices. No contracts, no ETFs, no ride-along or bundling, no overage charges or penalties. You know, you pay only for what you use. And look what you get for free. You get voicemail, caller ID, tethering is free and included, hotspot free and included, three-way calling, call forwarding, all these features built in. You don't get mysterious line items. What was that? As many devices you want on a single plan. And by the way, you saw there, you get to choose your, the way it works is you go to their devices. Look at all the different phones. They've got everything, the Galaxy Note 2. They have inexpensive phones. And by the way, we're going to give you $25 off your first Ting device when you go to hamnation.ting.com. Galaxy Nexus, some really nice Android devices, BlackBerry devices, the Galaxy S3, which is still, to my feeling, the best phone ever made. I'm a Note fan. I like the big screen. Pick the phone you want. They'll send it to you. And then you activate it on the Ting network, and you're getting this great service at an amazing price. You got to try it. The support's fantastic, too, by the way. No hold customer support. When you call 1-855-TING-FTW, you get a representative. They're going to get your problem solved. They're not going to, and they're friendly. They're nice. They're Canadian. Enough said. But, of course, this is a service only available in the U.S. because it's based on Sprint. Great online support, too. Help.ting.com. Active customer forums. Very simple help ticketing system. They've got video tutorials, video startup guides. This is really how it ought to be done. I want you to visit hamnation.ting.com. Check out the savings calculator. See how much you can save. And you'll also save $25 on your first device when you sign up. Hamnation.ting.com. You love the Ham Nation show. How about your phone company? Mm-hmm. Now, back to the hams already in progress.
Thanks very much, Leo. We all have to support Ting. It's a great service also. Well, we are running so late. Cheryl, we want to get you in here for just a couple of minutes. Let's take a couple of things from the chat room. I know it's been really, really busy. And let's see what you got, if you got a couple of really important things there from the guys and gals. How you doing? Good to see ya.
Good to see you too. Hi, Bob. Hi, everybody. Welcome. I got your questions. I'm very happy to see you, everybody in the chat room tonight. So let's start. Of course, Bob, I'm going to start with you. I have KD0COR. He wants to know what mic you're using tonight. What microphone?
Oh, it's a PR40. Yeah, PR40 tonight. Ooh. And works great on AM, sideband, FM, and, of course, on all of Leo and a lot, but over 1,000 broadcasters. It's a great microphone. Thank you.
I have one, too. I like it a lot. And thanks for the answer. And there's another one, N0GHS. Bob, what antenna do you use on 40 meters and 75 meters? Tell us what about those antennas. I think I might know, but I'd like to hear it from you.
Well, you need to go back and look at program 63 or 65, some of those. They're coaxial dipoles, MIT-designed dipoles from IAS. Great antenna builder of coaxial dipoles. But I have, there's four of them out here in the meadow for 75 and 40. I have two of them are phased on 75, two phased on 40. And then I have an Omni one on 80 and an Omni one on 40. They really play big time. So go check that out on program 63. And while you're at it, everybody needs to know, we need to invite our friends to go back and watch some of the replays, because that's how things count for Leo. It's amazing, but just watching it here doesn't always count, and you need to go on the replays, and we bring the counts up for Leo, and it helps him. But go back and look at that program 63. There's some really good information there. Thanks, Cheryl.
Great. I just wanted to answer this for KC9UDA. I promised him an answer, and I'm going to try and tackle this one myself with a little help from K9LPK. He says, I'm getting a new vehicle, and I found out it's made of plastic. How would I mount the antenna? So here's the answer to this one. Mount it to the fiberglass and run a bonding ground from the shield to the base of the antenna as short as possible to the frame of the vehicle, and use a stainless steel or preferred copper one-inch wide minimum braided wire. Ground your engine to the frame, ground your exhaust to the frame, bond all metal together to the frame, and that should really pretty much handle it for you. So no worries there. Just make a nice, strong mounting job to that fiberglass / plastic, whichever the case may be. I think you're talking fiberglass, but that's that one. And I wanted to put this towards George, if he's still on here. It's KD6AXQ Dennis. George, if you're there,
yeah.
Can you tell us it says, George, is how do you inject solder paste into a PL? If you do inject solder paste into a PL-259, would it make a good connection or not?
I don't think I would do it. Solder paste is kind of expensive for that type of soldering, and I believe it melts at a lower temperature. So if you're running any power, you might, you shouldn't, but it's possible you could get that a little bit warm, and you wouldn't want the solder melting out of your PL-259. But to answer the question, yeah, it probably would work, but not the best solution.
Thank you for your answer.
You need one of these guys, Cheryl. This is what you need for PL-259s, right, George?
That's it.
Is that the Mondo soldering gun?
It.
I bet.
Yes.
Looks like it. And I think this one's for you, Bob, and I think we'll wrap it up with this. I know we're kind of short on the time frame here. So N3JPW Mark, he says, what's your favorite antenna tuner and why?
Oh, no. I hate antenna tuners. That's why I use coaxial dipoles. Antenna tuners just soak up your power and fool. Oh, I have to have a whole program. Don't get me started on antenna tuners. Really, I'm serious. You shouldn't need an antenna tuner if your antenna is broadband and coaxial dipoles are broadband. I have less than 2-to-1 from band edge to band edge on 160, 75, 40, all of those bands because of the MIT designed coaxial dipole. So you don't need an antenna tuner and it's not going to suck up your power. It's I know a lot of guys, I want one piece of wire to do it all. Really, take another look at that because you're really wasting power with an antenna tuner. Good topic, and it's a good place to start arguments, Cheryl. But
I didn't mean it that way. Pudding. You know that. But can you take one last one? It's perfect for you. It's about a microphone, yours. So what is What's the difference between the ideal mic for single sideband and the ideal mic for AM, FM? Is there a difference? Just curious.
No.
That's what they want to know.
No, shouldn't be. No, you can do one microphone does it all, and because your transmitters today have equalization in them, and you can equalize and balance. That's a problem. A lot of guys don't understand balancing, and we need to probably get into that one of these nights. But one microphone works good, and we prove that every day here on the bands. That's what all this stuff behind me is about. So there you are. Thanks, Cheryl. We appreciate you watching.
I want to add one quick thing, Bob, if I could. One microphone is enough, but it's more fun to have two, like me. I have two Heil microphones. So
there you go.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great time. We'll see you next time.
Like you say, I why do you need all those radios? Because I need them. Thanks, everybody. This was a very, very informative show. Go back and look at the replays. Pass it on to your clubs. Think about it. Wouldn't this be a great club meeting presentation? And I do a lot of club meetings. Gordon does some. George does some. We'll be doing one in Texas Friday night. We do ham fests where they put up a big screen and bring George or Gordo or I. Think about it. What a great way to bring more programming of interest to your club. And we can do it with Ham Nation. We can do it with Skype. It's a wonderful thing. Thanks, everybody. We appreciate you being here. George W1LSB, you're just a delight and such a scientist of single sideband. A couple of weeks, we're going to have him back with Nick Tusa, and we're going to talk all about the guy that invented single sideband for ham radio. So we have had a wonderful night, 7-3 to all. We're going to dial over to 7268. And see if the guys are on 40. They might be a little high to low, depends on what's going on. We'll definitely get down to 3850 with Cheryl and her gang. So see you later. In the meantime, I'm going to go read the rest of my new electric radio. And thanks to Ray and all the guys that put that magazine together. Talk to you next week right here on the Twit Network, Ham Nation. This is K9EID. Bye-bye for now.